morning. We will do the best we can at getting through the calendar. I ask for your patience. There are a lot of detailed bills up. There's a lot of fiscal notes before us, and so the committee is going to be wrestling with a great deal of technicalities as well as policy decisions today. We have an amendment. We have House Bill 72 before us. We have an amendment number 2 pending before us. Senator Eliason?
Madam Chair, I've asked Senator Ray to come up to testify on the background of this particular amendment.
Okay.
It dates back the day they revamped the whole alcohol code. Senator Ray?
Senator Ray, sir?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Perhaps I should preface it. My expertise in this subject started in 1959 when I was appointed to the ABC board. And for four years I was acting chairman. One year I was acting chairman, I was chairman and acting director at the same time. So I am well acquainted with the bill. In 1980, I recodified the Title IV. And in the Senate version, the amendment as offered was in the Senate amendment, or was in the Senate bill, down to the point it had the additional language: if sales taxes are imposed on other sales within the municipality. That was in the Senate version. It went to a pre-conference in the House, and we were there for days with then Representative Parr, who was the chairman of the Judiciary, and it was discussed. The property taxes were discussed. Originally, there was no sale. There was no tax on property tax on liquor inventories because it was considered. The history on that, it was considered that the license fees were returned to the municipality, and that was in lieu of property taxes. As times have gone on and enforcement problems have come up, that's considered that the license fees should be used strictly for enforcement and not for anything else rather than that. So I would say, I don't know how this dropped out, except it was perhaps a technical or clerical error. It was never discussed to take it out. It was never anything considered, to my memory, it was never ever discussed, and it might have just been a technical error. In fact, two or three years after the bill had passed, when one of the municipalities, I believe it was either Juneau or one of the other ones, considered adding an additional tax, it surprised me immensely, and I said, well, I can't do that. And then I went to the bill and looked, and I wondered what had happened to it, where this thing had gone. And it was a surprise to me as well as it was to everybody else, I guess, it was handling it that was connected with the bill. And I don't know how it got out. It just dropped out some way. Because it was never the intent of the pre-conference committee to drop that out. Never.
Questions for Senator Ray? Senator Halper?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way the statute reads, in order to impose a sales tax, it has to be voted on by the local voters, doesn't it?
Every sales tax, I believe, under the charter.
So basically, if we adopt the amendment, we're saying that the voters can't impose a sales tax. I feel a little different about limitations on municipal power than I do on limitations on the voters' power. That's what I was trying to understand what the effect is.
Well, I'm not going to get into dialogue on what the municipal codes are or whatever their charters say. All I am doing is responding, I hope, positively to what had happened here in this particular instance. It would seem to me, if you want my personal opinion, it would be discriminatory to have an additional tax on anything. In other words, select an additional tax on matches because they have a lot of fires in town.
Well, we do, for example, allow boats to be taxed differently than houses, so that someone that lives on a $200,000 boat pays a tonnage fee, while someone that lives in a $200,000 house pays real property taxes at a substantially higher value.
Yes, I understand that, but you're also getting into who owns the property and how it originally got into being, such as boat harbors, and who maintains them and who doesn't maintain them, and where the original money was to put them in. And we know where property rights, we know who bought the property, and et cetera. So it's a different, you got an apple and an orange.
Further questions, Senator Elias?
Madam Chair, to answer the question that Senator Helfer posed, the only limitations we're imposing on local government is the fact that they cannot take a specific sales tax on a specific industry. What we're saying is that if you want to tax liquor and whatever else you want, might want it to tax, that's all right. But, you know, we don't want to put in, it's keeping any specific industry going out and point and saying, we're going to tax you and no one else. If you're taxing you and you, that's fine. Limitation is being, of course, that we're not zeroing in anything. They can, I think example was yesterday, if they were allowed to, on the ballot proposition, shall we impose a 10% tax on liquor and tobacco? That wouldn't be in violation of this provision. They could. On the other hand, if the proposition read, shall we impose a 10% tax on tobacco only, they couldn't under this provision.
Further questions? Discussion, Senator Ray.
I think that if you go back just historically, once again to repeat it, it was considered at that time that the additional revenues that were generated to the state through the sale of alcohol and the license fees were sufficient so that they wouldn't even pay an inventory tax. And then they decided, well, because of some of the problems that were inherent there, that it was okay to put that tax on, and it was okay to put a sales tax on if the sales tax was generated from everything else within the community. And why they would pick out and say you can charge this, it's a policy question, of course, and it's whatever the people want. But this was never intended to be left out of the bill, never.
Senator Petula?
Question, Senator Ray and Senator Lassen, separately. Senator, we're speaking to the amendment, and I know you put an awful lot of time and effort previously into making some sense out of the alcoholic beverage legislation. Do you know whether there was an attempt to provide this amendment, to request this amendment in the committees, the previous committees that this bill has been in?
There was never any suggestion, to my knowledge. We had an attorney from Legislative Affairs who worked with us. He no longer is employed by them, but he was very specific in what he called the state of the art, and making things rhyme out and sound nice, irrespective of what it really did. And I don't know whether in discussing this with the people in the House, where they just automatically dropped it out and said that it was covered by the sales tax on alcohol beverage sales. Or not. I don't know whether he felt that was sufficient in his knowledge, just the rest of the language might have been in his mind redundant, which it isn't, we all know, but in his mind it might have been.
And Senator Lassen,
that's the only excuse I could think of, is he might have thought it was a redundancy of some kind, or whoever it might have been, a legislative aide that thought it was a redundancy, but it was very specific language and it really means something.
There was no amendment proposed.
No, not to my knowledge.
And there's been none this year to any of the committees.
Not
on this.
Not to my knowledge, no.
Senator Eliason, this is a discussion we had yesterday on this subject. Your interpretation now is that a tax could be proposed by a municipality that would say two or more things could have sales tax, but could not say that just one.
One, period.
Because that was a discussion we ended up on the subject yesterday and didn't have an answer to. You've researched that.
Researched that. The attorney, I think, will verify that fact. What we're trying to do is avoid zeroing in on one specific industry for a specific tax.
So, but they could have not a general sales tax, but you could have it on two or more items.
That's right.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Senator Ray? Senator Ray, thank you for coming.
Thank
this
you very
morning.
Much,
appreciate
Chairman
that.
Members.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak on Amendment 2? Mr. Bridges?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Scott Burgess, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. Madam Chair, I've come for you today again on a bill that's been very important to municipalities over a number of years. On a specific amendment, we speak against the amendment for two main reasons. One, it is a policy issue that has not gone through processes that have dealt with this bill. It does amend Title 4 as opposed to Title 29, which is subject to the bill. So again, it's a matter, we've tried to keep controversial issues off this bill. It passed once before. Controversial issues were added at the last moment. It caused it to be vetoed. And we would hope that these issues would be brought before in separate legislation rather than tagged onto this bill. The second reason, of course, is to maintain local option. All sales taxes of any type have to be put before the voters and are imposed only at the will of the majority of the voters. And therefore, any tax contemplated, whether it be on alcohol only or other sales tax, would be voted for by the people. I do not know the specifics. Senator Ray mentioned the activity in 1980. This has come up very recently, and I haven't had a chance to do a lot of research on that. I did talk to the Juneau attorney who's been involved, was on the technical committee in Title 29, and as you know, Juneau, the senator mentioned that Juneau is one of the communities that does have a sales tax on liquor, was that there was a specific request during those hearings and the rewrite of that Title 4 by the alcoholism groups concerned to put that in there, and that my understanding is it was a conscious effort, but again, I was not there. That's about all I've been able to check, and the name that was given to me was Matt Felix, who I understand now works at the in the Department of Health and Social Services, was active in that, and I haven't had a chance to call him by this time, but that issue was raised, and it was a conscious effort. But in any event, we see this as an amendment, a new issue, potentially controversial, and we would oppose the amendment.
Questions for Mr. Burgess? Senator Sackett?
Just a statement. These committee substitutes that we have before us have been the result of people tinkering in every committee with all of their different amendments. That's why we come up with committee substitutes. And just because we happen to be the last committee of referral, there's no reason why we can't also tinker with the bill. It is not sacred. It's just a proposal before us.
Senator Fisher?
Just a question. You had indicated about when this bill was up before the governor vetoed it. Have you talked to the governor as to whether he felt this was anything critical as far as he's concerned?
No, I have not. It just came up. Madam Chair, excuse me. Again, due to the recentness of this issue being brought before, I have not been able to do a lot of research on this one.
Senator Ferguson?
I'd just like to say that, I'd like to call for the question.
Any other discussion? The question's been called for?
Oh, I have a question.
Senator Curtillo?
Question. It's been your position that you'd like to retain every option for a vote of the people in decisions like this, right? We'd like to maintain the right of the people to say yes or no to imposition of tax on liquor.
Yes, Madam Chair.
The local people.
That's correct.
Senator Lyson?
No, I have another question. This follows logically in my mind. It's also been my position that in a second-class borough, the legislation that created the borough stated that in a second-class borough, the people have a right to impose any new conditions on the borough that weren't imposed in the original act. But this legislation doesn't seek the vote of the people in which to impose some new conditions upon them. Now, is there a consistent philosophical point of view you're expressing here now or not?
Madam Chair, in response to the Senator's question, I think you're referring to the new power of economic development. Again, I'm at somewhat of a loss here. This bill's been around a long time. I don't know why economic development was added as a power, specifically not requiring a vote of the people as an additional power for a second-class borough to exercise. It is a non-area-wide exercise of that power, and my understanding, or can only suppose that the reason that might be, is one, that economic development is something that both the state as a government and local communities have been trying to encourage economic development of those communities, providing jobs, et cetera, and that it's possible that for a non-area-wide, for example, an industrial site, to provide that land so that it would stimulate economic development. But as far as why that's not a power that would be exercised through a vote of the people, I don't know why that was put in there. And I understand potential conflict there, what you're saying, as far as pushing for a vote in one case and not in the other.
I just wanted to bring it to the attention of the committee.
Senator Lassie.
Madam Chair, I certainly concur with Senator Sackett's remarks. I'm amazed that you're talking about we're only dealing with Title 29. I don't know if you read the bill, or just going through it, we're dealing with Title 9, Title 14, Title 15, Title 28, Title 20, 38. We're dealing with all these titles, so why all of a sudden it's sacred only to deal with Title 29? Can you tell us that?
Madam Chair, to respond, one is there's no intent that, in fact, that this bill shouldn't have a review of all committees to which it was referred, but both the House and the Senate, and in fact, has been. Amendments have been added. In some cases, we've supported those. In some cases, we haven't. The concern here is that we not get into new policy areas and that we try and get this bill that had the review, statewide hearings, had the support, issues were added that brought in new issues. You're right. I misspoke. It obviously deals with other sections, Title 42 on utilities. The concern here is the prohibition on introduction of sales tax on liquor specifically is something that was addressed in the revisions of Title 4. The grant in Title 29, the reason it deals with Title 29 is that the grant of power of a municipality to exercise sales tax is given within Title 29. The issue of alcoholism is dealt with in Title 4. And the concern here is whether a municipality should have the right to tax on, have a tax on sales. The issue before you is whether that sales tax should be limited before. And again, it's a new major concern there is a new policy issue.
Further questions for Mr. Burgess? Mr. Burgess, thank you very much. I'd like to remind you that just sitting here, there's over 90 years of legislative experience sitting at this table among five gentlemen. So there's a lot of experience here. And if the bill gets tinkered with or looked at or diagnosed here, there's a lot of experience sitting at this table to do that. And it would be impossible for this group not to look very closely at every bill they get.
Further discussion on Amendment 2. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on Amendment 2? Commissioner?
Yes, Madam Chair, after reading the amendment...
For the record, sir, please.
I'm Jeff Smith. I'm the Acting Commissioner of Department of Community and Regional Affairs. After looking at the amendment and talking with my staff and some other people, the department supports the amendment.
Questions for the Commissioner? Any other... Thank you, Commissioner. Anyone else in the audience wish to address Amendment 2? Okay, you have a motion before you. It's been moved that we adopt Amendment 2. All those in favor, signify by raising your hand. All those opposed? Amendment 2 is adopted. Thank you very much. We have before us Amendment number 3. Senator Ferguson?
Madam Chairman, I'd like for someone from the...
Okay, would you move the amendment, sir, so it's just before us?
I'd move that we adopt amendment number 3.
Okay, amendment number 3 is before us. There are folks in the audience who are here to speak on amendment 3. Ted Burns, would you come forward, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ted Burns. I am an attorney. I'm vice president for Multivision's cable television in Anchorage. We noted, and unfortunately rather late in the game, a potential problem with one section in HB 72. It is a very complex bill, as we're all aware, and although it has been read and reread and analyzed and reanalyzed, there still remain, as we've just seen, questions. This is a situation in which existing law is being changed. The existing powers of municipalities are being expanded, and I think it's important to focus on that. Present law dealing with the ability of municipalities to adopt franchises and engage in franchise regulation is covered under 2948.050 of the code. That section, which applies to all municipalities, home rule and non-home rule, basically says, among other things, that municipalities cannot engage in franchise regulation for public utilities, utilities that are regulated under the Public Utilities Commission. The replacement for that section has been eliminated, and a replacement section has been inserted in its place. It says, in essence, the same thing. It says that municipalities may not grant franchises and engage in franchise regulation to utilities certified that hold Alaska Public Utilities Commission certificates of public convenience. However, that section has now become inapplicable to home rule municipalities. This means that municipalities such as Kenai, Juneau, Anchorage, and many of the other home rule boroughs and cities will now be free to adopt, if they so choose, franchise regulations, which would affect public utilities such as cable television. This would allow, among other things, the imposition of franchise taxes. Federal law now prevents franchise taxes of up to 5% of gross revenues. I would note that this taxing ability would be in addition to any other local sales tax, I believe, at least the way I read the bill. So in essence, you could result to the city, I think the limit is 6% on sales taxes, if a city chose to adopt a franchise for a cable system and impose the full 5% fee, you could have consumers paying, in essence, an 11% sales tax. Other things that are typically done by way of franchise, and this is in the lower 48, are regulations of customer service policies, regulation of line extension policies, regulation of ownership of systems. It's not uncommon to have provisions for mandatory buyouts at the end of franchise periods. And municipalities have, in some cases, tried to enforce those. So it's a matter of some concern. It is a significant change in existing law, and one that we think ought to be focused on separately. The fact that I think Senator Ray alluded to the fact that in a bill of this complexity, surprises can occur. One can find out years later that things were changed and that only when the issue happens to arise do you realize that there was a subtle change. I think that's kind of the situation here that we're trying to address. In terms of this, trying to keep controversial positions out of the bill, I think this is a case where there is one that has a great potential for controversy included in it, and it would be our preference, I believe, to go back to the status quo, to make the section applicable to all municipalities, again, as it is now, and if franchising is a legitimate issue, perhaps deal with it as a separate matter next session or in some future legislative session. I guess with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the table? Senator Hopper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we adopt this amendment, we have not at all weakened the municipality's ability to control easements, cable extensions, installation, use of streets, roads.
As far as right-of-way matters, that is covered in the Public Utilities Code. The site is 4205-251, and it states in there that cities do have the right to regulate their streets and right-of-ways by the permitting process, and it sets up the Alaska Public Utilities Commission to arbitrate any disputes between utilities and cities as to the terms and conditions of street and right-of-way use. That language is not affected by this bill at all.
But a municipality, for example, could require that all lines be underground.
Yes, that is not affected by this section at all. In fact, the city of Anchorage has an ordinance doing exactly that.
Further questions? Ted, thank you very much. Is there someone else to testify for Amendment 3? Mr. Burgess.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Scott Burgess, Alaska Municipal League. Again, as you indicated before, I'm speaking to several individuals who have a lot more experience at this than I, as well as the person that testified previous, Mr. Byrne, who was involved in, as a technical committee member, in the writing of this legislation. My understanding is that this is the amendment, not the first section of this amendment, if I in fact have the correct one. There's two references, one to page 34 and one to page 202. Okay, so I'm reading from the right one. He's correct, again, as quickly as I could review the issue here, that under those limitations to home rule, that the section dealing with franchises and permits was left out. And therefore, that first section would add that back in as it is in current law. However, and I would defer to Ms. Cook, too, if I'm incorrect in that, whether that was intended or not, I'm saying that would, in fact, bring it back to existing law. However, in the second section, this language was added in fairly recent legislation, I believe in the last legislature, dealing with those utilities that can be exempted from APUC regulation and deals with co-ops and deals with certain telephone companies making under a certain amount of money and with cable companies. And those are referred to in D through K. B and C. B deals with municipal under 4205.711 and actually talks about municipally owned public utilities. However, if you look at the site that's in parentheses at the bottom of that, AS 2948090, that does not include the previous AS 2948050, which in fact is the site on franchising permits. So the exemption for those, and I believe Mr. Byrne is speaking for a cable TV company, And the exemption provided from APUC by this change to Title 42 did not give them an exemption to the franchise and permits. And by adding this second section, the way I read that, it would add that to those utilities exempted. And would, again, it's very difficult to deal in an area of utilities. I'm certainly not an expert, but it adds confusion in talking to folks in Juneau and in Anchorage. It does change law. The effects of that, total effects, I'm not an expert.
Questions? Tam, what is your analysis of the 202 language, page 202 language?
Is it 202? Are you talking about the second half of...
Yes.
Okay. Right now, existing law, the spanned reference is set out in his amendment, that's accurate. It spans 2948060 to 2948090. That is the existing reference. As Mr. Burns testified, the provision that's now the counterpoint of this franchises, as it's been renumbered, was 2948050. So that particular section, the section on franchises, is not now dealt with in the provision that he's amending. He's suggesting that it be dealt with in the section, and that would be a change from the status quo right now.
Well, I'm confused. Let's run it through. Tell us what the status quo is right now.
Right now,
in existing law.
Right now, the amendment that he's presented to the committee accurately sets out the statute as it is printed. The material in parentheses there sets out the statutory sites that are covered under this provision. The section dealing with franchises and permits is 2948050. It's not right now dealt with in this particular section under existing law.
But if we adopt his amendment, would we be adopting the status quo?
No, we would be also including 2948050 within this particular provision. We would be inserting the section dealing with franchises and permits as well. It's not now in there.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Stack.
What is the effect of doing that?
Precisely.
Actually, I think that this is a fairly complex area that they could stand more than a superficial looking into. One of the effects of doing that, this particular provision says in a municipality that a person, utility, or cooperative that is exempt from regulation would not be subject to regulation by a municipality under the franchises and permits section, which means that they could not charge a permit or impose reasonable terms and conditions. That's the language that's contained in existing law for the use of streets and right-of-ways. Under existing law, they are required to make streets and right-of-ways available to utilities that are regulated. In the case of cable TV, we have an interesting question because cable TV is in fact not regulated. It is a specifically exempted utility. That's my understanding. So I'm curious as to how the franchises and permits section that exists right now actually applies to cable TV. It may be that municipalities have a little more power in the area of cable TV than they would a regulated utility. Also, the committee ought to bear in mind that in the Title 29 revision bill, rather than preserving the phrase utilities regulated under 42005 or whatever it is, they instead have inserted the phrase that franchises and permits sections applies to utilities certificated by APUC. I'm not sure whether cable TV are in fact certificated under APUC. So it could be that even the limitations contained in the franchises and permits section would not apply right now to the cable TV, which is in an unusual status of being an exempted. It's specifically exempted from regulation.
Senator Ferguson.
I'd like Ted to come back from Multivision and explain this further.
Any questions for Mr. Burgess?
Well, Ted is coming up here. I do have a question.
For Mr. Burns? Oh, for Tam?
Yeah, both.
Okay. Any more questions for Mr. Burgess so I can dismiss him? Thank you. Mr. Burns, would you come forward, please? And Senator Cotullo, you have a question for Ms. Cook.
You do have, of course, the interesting unsolved problem, and your testimony so far leaves it open too in the interpretation of the law, and that is when a regulated utility also picks up a cable television franchise and uses its allowable right of trespass or whatever you might want to call it to plow in a cable instead of for the telephone, but for who controls that? Does the PUSC control that, or does the local, or who does? You understand now you have a regulated utility doing something that really probably is not regulated right at the moment.
So far as I know, that would be an unregulated activity. I don't know if
that would be totally exempt.
Yeah, for regulation. It's not regulated by the state.
But they're not subject either to the rights of way that the regulated portion has necessarily, right? You can't necessarily plow in a cable in a regulated utility's ditch just because that regulated utility all of a sudden has the has that option. That's a question that's been asked in the course.
To tell you the truth, I don't know. I would have to look into that further.
It would be an interesting one that might save a lot of litigation.
Certainly would.
Thank you.
Mr. Burns?
We have two types of regulation that I think it's important to help us understand to separate those. On the one hand, the right-of-way permitting process, which deals with the day-to-day use of public streets and right-of-way. Things like how deep cables can be buried, how far from the center line of the street they can be laid, what order utilities will be installed in public rights of way. Those things formerly were mentioned in Title 29 in the old section. The language that appeared there has been omitted from the present Title 29 bill from day one. The reason it was omitted is that it was identical and duplicative of the language that was in the Public Utilities Code that I mentioned earlier, Title 42. That is preserved. It's merely eliminated here as a matter of duplication. And if you would want to take the two and look at them, I think you could see that very readily. That literally the identical verbatim language appeared in two different titles of the code. It was simply eliminated from here and dealt with under the public utilities section. It is in no way whatsoever affected by anything in this bill. Public utilities have a right to use municipal streets and rights of way, but cities have the right to establish permits and to impose, I believe the language is, reasonable terms and conditions and a reasonable permit fee. None of that is in any way, shape, or form affected by anything that is going on in the present Title 29 bill. I think it was simply a matter of separating those two. The present section now deals primarily with franchising, which is a different matter. Franchising gets into the other forms of regulation that I mentioned earlier, the franchise fees, the customer service policies, the restrictions on, in some cases, cities have tried to get into programming, detailing what kind of programming can be allowed on systems. That is what we are concerned with. They have no concern over regulation of public streets and right-of-ways.
Mr. Burns, I think the committee needs an explanation as to your amendment is in two parts, okay? The first part, I think everyone realizes that's existing law, or if we adopt your amendment, we would be reverting to existing law, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of controversy about that. The questions we have are in the second half of your amendment, beginning on page 202, line 2, replacing with the following. That seems to have struck a chord that it's a policy call here. It's something different is happening, and we need some explanation.
Certainly. It is not a change, although I can easily see where it appears that it is. The earlier section, if you note on page 20, is it 202 or 201, the section that is dealing with 4205.711, Tam Cook is correct, of course, that the earlier franchise section was not dealt with there. One of the reasons it wasn't dealt with was that, by its terms, cities were precluded from granting franchises to regulated utilities. The suggested amendment is merely a matter of consistency. If, in fact, cities, as they are at present, should be prohibited from engaging in franchise regulation of public utilities, the proposed amendment on page 201 or 202 merely is a consistency. It eliminates an otherwise inconsistent statement in the law. One other point, by the way, that I think just for the record, it's a misnomer to say that cable television is unregulated by the Public Utilities Commission, that it is unregulated for certain specific things. We still must have a certificate of public convenience and necessity. We can be called before the commission for any violation of any term or condition of those. Subscribers have the right to petition the commission for further regulation. So I think just for the record, we don't want to think that we are totally unregulated by the PUC. That is simply not the case.
Questions for Mr. Burns? Okay, thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Anyone else who wishes to testify? Mr. Burgess, you've already testified on this amendment. Anyone new who wishes to testify on this amendment? Any other discussion? The motion before us is should amendment number 3 be adopted. All those in favor of adopting amendment number 3, raise your hand. All those opposed? Amendment number 3 has been adopted. We have before us Amendment Number 4, Senator Sackett.
Pull that off to the bottom of the calendar.
Amendment Number 4 will become at the bottom of the calendar. We have before us Amendment Number 5. Let's see, who's Amendment Number 5? I can't remember. Amendment Number 5 is Representative Galvin. Is he here? Yes. Senator Halper, would you move Amendment Number 5, please, so it's before us?
So moved.
So moved. Thank you. Amendment Number 5 is before us. Representative Gall.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Maybe I could just take the liberty for a moment to thank the Senate and this committee and the previous committees that have worked on the bill. I'm a little less concerned with the controversial nature of some of the amendments than are some other people, and I'm looking forward to working with this committee to get a good bill through the Senate and hopefully get concurrence by the House. I would like to ask one question of the committee, if I could, and that is your interpretation of Amendment Number 2.
Okay, Representative Gall, we've got a huge, huge calendar today. We've got Amendment Number 5 before us.
Amendment Number 5 deals with eminent domain in the House. The eminent domain provision for second-class cities was adopted, which provided that a vote of the people is required for a second-class city to exercise eminent domain. However, it was not any longer necessary, as it was in previous law, for a second-class city to go to the Department of Community and Regional Affairs to seek approval. First-class cities, of course, enjoy the power of eminent domain. This amendment is, in a sense, a reflection of the change that was made in Senate Judiciary, which replaced in the statutes what had been eliminated in the original bill, stating that a municipally owned utility could acquire property extraterritorially to provide service. That's a noble purpose, but when you combine all these things, the vote of the people in authorizing eminent domain, the right of a municipality to act extraterritorially, it seems appropriate that eminent domain be exercised within the corporate boundaries of the municipality and not within the corporate boundaries of some other municipality or some unincorporated area. The amendment merely limits the power of eminent domain to the municipalities where I believe it belongs, and this has been brought to me by a number of members of the House who are concerned about this.
Senator Halper.
I like the amendment.
Oh, do you have any questions?
I've got to move it now.
I knew you would, Senator Halper. Is there any questions for Representative Gall? Representative Gall, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on Amendment 5? I knew you'd want to come up here. Mr. Burgess.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Scott Burgess, Alaska Municipal League. We are dealing, again, the power to exercise eminent domain outside the boundaries is an existing law. There is, in fact, that power is a traditional power of both the state and political subdivisions of the state to exercise in the public interest to provide a service to the public. Not only is that a power enjoyed by municipalities, it's also a power enjoyed by private utility companies, co-ops, mining companies, in references within the statute that, in fact, to provide a utility, even at a private, on behalf of a private company, to provide a utility or provide a service to the public, that it can exercise the power of eminent domain, and surely the vote of the people is not involved in that issue. So again, this is, in fact, a power to provide eminent domain, to provide a service to the public. Fair market value is given. It's controlled by the courts. It's a very stiff review of whether, in fact, that is necessary in the public interest to provide a utility, and, in fact, fair compensation is given. And, for example, in a utility for a water system, a community may not have a water source within the community, but outside the community, if, in fact, it's not regulated by a jurisdiction out there, it can go out there and provide that water service for the citizens in its community.
Question, Senator Eliason?
Madam Chair, we don't like anything we're doing today, do we? Has this amendment been proposed before other committees of legislation?
No, it has not.
By adopting this amendment, this would require municipalities to go to the legislature or to the state government to exercise eminent domain outside their boundaries. Is that correct?
I'm not sure what the effect. That's probably a reasonable. I defer to the attorney on that. Whether, in fact, if a municipality, let's say, needed a water source
outside of their boundaries,
how they would go about getting that, I don't know. Perhaps they could go to the state.
Can you answer that question?
Unless through annexation, that may be a possibility.
Right. Under the terms of this amendment, I don't think a municipality would be able to acquire a right-of-way other than unless it was able to get the landowners to agree to transfer the needed easement voluntarily. It might be that a municipality could prevail upon the state to act in certain situations. That's a possibility. But I'm not sure that would always be a possibility for a municipality.
Senator Halford, then Cotulla.
Yeah. It's amazing that we have in law extraterritorial powers of eminent domain without any check currently from the state. I don't have any problem with municipalities going through the state to exercise eminent domain. But to think that a municipality could take, by declaration of taking, by eminent domain, the private property of another who resided outside of the municipality, had no vote and basically no recourse other than to come to the state himself to stop that, is something that, it's one of the things that as I read through this bill and saw this thing in the Judiciary Committee, I just didn't want to read any further.
Senator Cotulla.
I have run into this a number of times, and I don't think it's a power that ought to be granted the municipality except the way that Senator Halford has stated. As a matter of fact, I suspect I was the government resource that allowed for some intelligence when 2 years ago we jointly provided funds for the city of Seward to get an electrical connection, a more substantial power line. Ties into Chugach, ties into Seward's needs. Very logical. And my share of that was probably $5 million of effort. Seward needed it. There were other resources provided, a total of $10 million, so that they could get sufficient electricity. Some many years ago in the Moose Pass area, the good citizens of Moose Pass, the community lies right along the road in the trench, gave their land free and clear so that Seward could get electrical line. Some of those lots got rather small as a result of that. And lo and behold, in the arrogance of whoever it may be, power, whatever, they decided they'd take the rest of the land in some cases, or practically all. Most people have been there a long time. They're 20 miles or 10 miles or 6 or 8. I don't know how far out of the city is Seward. But Seward needed the electricity, right? They felt a little bit concerned about their citizens out there. Finally, I ended up in the middle of the whole thing. I didn't much appreciate it for reasons that are quite obvious, about 30 days before a campaign, I think that the municipalities going to resolve a problem for water or sewer or for electric line connections really ought to have more than just a convenient section to acquire that right away when it's not in their own cities, not in their own borders. I think that ought to be made available. I think it ought to be made available the same way that Senator Halford is now speaking, through negotiation, and if it's state responsibility, through the state as their agent, not the other way around. Those people were about to be abused.
Senator Halford.
There's two sections that deal with the effect outside the municipalities. Extraterritorial jurisdiction. Provision, although the extraterritorial powers for watershed protection and so forth, there may be some justification for those things.
Yeah.
And if a private buyer, a private seller, is willing to sell a facility to the municipality, I haven't got a problem with that. But if, in fact, they go outside of their boundaries and take from someone who cannot even vote in that municipality, who has no protection, other than to come to the state as a private individual and try to stop it through a pretty difficult process, I think we're loading the system a little bit against the resident for the municipalities in a way that's not necessary.
It just proves you don't own anything, that's all.
Okay.
Question?
Questions to call for? Is there any other discussion from the senators? Mr. Burgess, thank you very much. Any other discussion from from the senators? Amendment before you is to adopt amendment number 5. All those in favor, signify by raising your hand. All those opposed, amendment number 5 is adopted. We have before us amendment number 6. What I'd like to do is get through the amendments, finish this bill up if we can today, then take a brief at ease for a few minutes.
Yeah, amendment number 6.
Amendment number 6, Senator Sackett.
Senator Coghill, I'd like to testify in this bring before the body. I'd like to move for adoption of amendment number 6.
Amendment number 6 is before us, Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Amendment number 6 is to lift
the present section on page 164 and to insert the status quo, to take the legislature or the section 2980-89050 and put it back in. And the reason for it is that you have a couple court cases going on right now with Noatak and Akasuk. And the thing is that what we want to do, what we're trying to do in this amendment is to put it back to status quo. It has to do with the native villages and the 25, the unincorporated villages and the $25,000 that's gone to them. The thing is that the Community and Regional Affairs Agency has said that this is basically the language that is in the bill now is what they are doing, but the old law identifies basically what a native village government means. And so what we're doing is that I'm asking the committee, and this was called to our attention after it had gone through regional community fair.
Senator Coghill, where is this located in the bill?
In the bill, page 164. We're deleting 2960-140 in its entirety and adding section 2989-050 of the municipal code as it is today, according to your mention. It's status quo. We're not changing anything.
Okay,
taking it back to where it is today.
Okay, let me just get through this. What's in the book, 164, what's in the bill, 2960-140 is new,
yes.
New law, new language. You would like to substitute that language for the status quo, which is currently section 2989-050 in the municipal code.
That is correct. And we're going to, Representative Paul and I are going to be dealing with a statute in the next session of the legislature, Madam Chairman, putting in eight basic steps of government going from the IRA, the traditional village councils, all the way up through first, second class, third class cities.
Any questions for the Senator? Thank you very much. Anyone else in the audience wish to address Amendment Number 6? Representative Gall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Peter Gall. I support the amendment, and I agree with Senator Coghill that some of the fine-tuning can be done during the interim and next year. But there's one section in the existing bill that you might want to consider, and I have no position on it except to bring it to your attention, that among the changes made in the statute in the section as written is the waiver of sovereign immunity with regard to the monies received. I don't know whether or not the committee wishes to deal with that, but I bring it to your attention that specifying that it go to the village governments is maintaining of existing law, and I don't know whether you wish to get into this other issue, but that was one of the major sections
okay.
in the if area it, being deleted.
It's not an amendment, but Senator Sacker.
No. I was just going to say that the waiver is a part of the existing
right. That I was just saying. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other discussions? Anyone else in the audience wish to address? Commissioner, please. Senator Sackett, do you wish Senator's Amendment 7 before 4 or after?
I'm going to withdraw 4.
Oh. Sorry?
No, it's under discussion.
Amendment number 6 has been moved. It's on the table. I mean, it's before us for discussion. We're into discussion.
Madam Chair, thank you. When the changes were made to the revenue sharing program back in 1980 and this language was included, an attorney general's opinion was given.
Excuse me, just a second. We need it quiet in the room. It's very difficult to hear. Commissioner.
An attorney general's opinion was given that stated that this language was unconstitutional and the department would be required to provide this aid to all unincorporated communities. That opinion was further amended to exclude those unincorporated communities located in the organized borough, which we have been implementing that way for the past 4 years and would continue to implement whether this amendment is adopted or not. We would continue operating the program under the attorney general's opinion that states that all unincorporated communities outside of organized boroughs should receive this aid.
Questions for the commissioner? Senator Halford.
So basically we'd be reinserting language that, according to the attorney general, is unconstitutional to implement as it is stated in the language.
Yes, and we have, the department has never implemented that section the way that was written in statute.
Let me get this straight. The department is, the attorney general has said the existing language is unconstitutional?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Senator Sack.
As I understand it now, there is a court case or a number of court cases on this, going through the courts right now, on the Attorney General's opinion as to whether this is unconstitutional. And what happened in 2960-140 was that basically they took the Attorney General's opinion and are now attempting to incorporate that into statute. And I just think that if it's before the court, let the court determine until they determine one way or another, rather than put it into the statute and then have to change it.
Further discussion? Senator Halford.
I think we ought to have the Attorney General's opinion before us and see what the grounds are.
We can hold the bill.
Senator Sackett, do you mind if we hold this over? This one?
No.
Amendment 6? All right. How do we do that legally? I mean,
just keep the amendment in the bill.
Keep it in the bill and hold the bill.
Okay. Amendment number 7. We'll put amendment number 6 on the table for right now. We'll hold it.
Madam Chairman, withdraw amendment number 4. And I'd like to move on number 7.
Number 7 is before us.
Number 7 takes 2935020 extraterritorial jurisdiction. The existing law included public utilities, and it was tinkered with in the last committee. Judiciary, they took it out. And this amendment would put that back into existing law of including utility services. And if there's a good reason why it should be taken out, I'd like to hear it, because nobody's told me yet.
Discussion. Who is here to testify on amendment number 7?
The department is here also. They agree with my amendment.
Okay.
Thank the chair. I was not aware that the amendment was coming up. I might explain that the...
Please, you identify yourself, sir, for the record.
Dave Hutchins, executive director of the Alaska Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And our association had proposed the change in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And what we proposed was that public utilities be removed from that that one section, and then the existing law be reinstated as an amendment subsequent subsection. Which covers specifically the extraterritorial powers related to public utilities. And that was strictly retaining existing law.
Senator Sackett.
If you look at the Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 72 Judiciary, they have a new section C there. And as I understand it, this is a fight between Valdez and electric utility down there. The department can speak to the amendment.
This C, which is new to this bill from earlier drafts, is a reenactment of existing law exactly as it is.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchins. Are there any other questions for Mr. Hutchins? Okay. Commissioner, where'd you go? Amendment number 7, Commissioners, before us.
Madam Chair, when this amendment was first proposed in the Judiciary Committee, we opposed it, and we would support Senator Sackett's amendment to reinstate it back to the language that was contained in the bill that came out of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee.
But why, Commissioner? The point is, we are being told that this, what's in the bill now is the status quo, and it's what's existing in law. And Tam, you verify that that's existing law. Well, why do we want to change it? That's what we need to know.
Due to... my understanding is...
Commissioner, if it's easier for Tam to explain it to us,
okay.
We'll take Ms. Cook's explanation. That's fine. We just need to know.
In subsection C, as it appears in the copy of the bill that you have in front of you now, you'll notice that this is existing language. It says that a municipality that owns or operates a utility may extend its service into adjacent areas. That's the bone of contention that's come up over the last few years involving this section. By removing subsection C and instead... inserting the word utility service or utilities into the extraterritorial jurisdiction section under A, you have removed the limitation that they may only extend utilities into adjacent areas. And that was a very deliberate change in the law made in the earlier drafts of the bill.
So now they can just go plop over there 10 miles away.
That was essentially, the earlier drafts of the bill would have allowed that result, yes.
Oh, and now they can't?
This is existing law, which contains the language adjacent areas.
Okay. So they can't extend their utilities now unless it's in an area that's adjacent. But let's say that Anchorage wanted to supply Point McKenzie with utility service. We could not do that.
Right.
Okay.
The municipalities, when this issue first came up 4 or 5 years ago when the bill was being worked on, municipalities very, very much wanted to get rid of this limitation on adjacent service because of situations such as the Point McKenzie situation. Here in Juneau, before Juneau was unified, if the city of Juneau had wanted to extend services to the valley and skip the land in between, there might have been a problem for them. That type of example was used with the original draft when the language was changed.
Further discussion on Amendment Number 7, Senator Curtula.
What is the problem specifically, I think, mentioned right here between Valdez and the electric association that services it? What is that problem spelled out?
I'm not familiar with the Valdez problem. I am familiar with that there are some cases where a municipality...
I mentioned
that was brought to my attention. I don't know what the problem is. I just want to know why it was changed.
I'd like to see this amendment held over, too.
Okay. We've got two amendments held over, 6 and 7. Is there any other amendments pending that we don't know about yet? Mr. Burgess?
Testify on number 7, or do you want to...
Why don't we hold, because we've got it. We've got 6 and 7 before us. Okay? Any other discussion on the bill this time? All righty. We'll put the bill away. We've got 6 and 7 pending. We'll bring it up tomorrow. Let's take a 3-minute at ease. Order, please. We have before us House Bill 81. It's the emissions control bill, motor vehicle emissions inspection. We have Lee Husson and Ken Lausen from Anchorage and Fairbanks as witnesses. Would you two gentlemen come forward, please? The committee requested a CS be drafted to provide an amendment. The CS is in your packet. To provide Section 5 on page 3, an exemption section.
What bill are we up?
81.
Thank you very much.
And then, because we did that, and Jens, correct me if I'm wrong, because we put that Section 5 in here, we didn't completely do it, and so we need an amendment. And would you pass these amendments out to everybody? This is amendment number 1.
On what page, Madam Chair?
I'll go through it. We have a CS in front of us.
Oh, I see this very...
The committee requested an exemption section put in. Senator Lysen doesn't have the CS. Yeah, and Senator Lysen needs a CS. And is Ms. Nelson here to tell us? Oh, very good. Section... Part 5 of Section 3, on page 3...
Are these supposed to be in effect?
...is the area that we added in Senate Finance. Legislative Legal left something out. That's Amendment Number 1, and the AG's department is here to tell us that if we have, on page 3, Part 5 in there, we have to have the Department of Law's amendment, and they'll speak to that. In fact, Lisa, why don't you come forward and speak to that right now? There's a chair over here.
Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is Lisa Nelson. I'm Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Division Department.
Okay, Lisa, you're going to have to speak up. You're going to have to speak slower.
Okay. I saw the amendment that you provided this morning for the first time, and it certainly appears to address the concerns that you had. All that needs to be done is a technical change. I called the reviser, and he felt that he could not do that, and I called the legislative drafting, and they said that it was an oversight. That change needs to be made in B because you added a fifth section there to A, and B refers to 1 through 4, and you would have to put 1 through 5 then to make it apply in B as well. And I assume that you want that fifth requirement to also apply to municipalities that are of a population of less than 1,000.
Okay, run through that one more time. Where are we?
Okay, on the third page...
Third page.
...of your committee substitute, you provided a fifth section for 4603210A, and that's your requirement that you want a waiver. Okay, on B of 4603210, it mentions...
Where is that?
That's not on your CS, but it's in existing law.
Oh, okay, in existing.
It mentions 1 through 5 of this section, or 1 through 4, and since you added a fifth subsection, you would have to refer to that in B below.
Okay. Senator Ferguson?
I don't have an unpopular thing.
I'm getting very confused with the amendment, too.
Okay. We need another copy of the committee substitute. All right, let's take a brief...
...to municipalities of less than 1,000 if they have a program.
Madam Chair?
We're at ease now. I want to order. Now, Lisa, start from the beginning.
Yeah, I haven't been... Started.
Now, what we were trying to do yesterday is, first of all, none of us like this program, I think. Nobody wants to do this anyway. But we say they tell us we have to do this, so you're fighting us uphill on this one, okay? We wanted to exempt automobiles that were from the emissions control program, particularly in Anchorage and Fairbanks, where this is going to be done. If they were registered there but used somewhere else, they shouldn't have to follow these guidelines. Okay, so we put this little exemption in there. And now you're confusing us.
Okay, that exemption, the way it was written by legislative drafting, only applied to municipalities of 1,000 or more. And that's because the subsection in existing law, A, only applies to municipalities of 1,000 or more. Subsection B provides for municipalities of 1,000 or less. And it says that the requirement should apply in subsection A.
But Lisa, we only want it to apply to Anchorage and Fairbanks. And all we're trying to do is make sure that those cars that are there, that are used somewhere else, don't have to be flown back in there to apply for this. Now, how come we're getting involved with other municipalities?
Right.
Okay, that would only apply in the future. If in some case a small town had an extreme pollution problem and DEC would have to come in and say that they would have to have some kind of emission control program, and then this amendment would apply.
Oh, how scary. Senator Ferguson.
Madam Chairman. I don't know why you're dragging us into a problem that doesn't exist for us.
When the problem
does come up, we'll address it in the law, but don't try to...
What is a town of 1,000?
Unrequested goods. I suppose Matt's super, right?
1,000?
Yeah, but...
There's not 1,000, it's a very small group of people.
Senator Fisher.
In addition to all these problems, I'm really curious, because if you have a second-class borough that does not have this power to begin with, you mean DECT went to communities like the Mill Chick and say, you will have an admission, assuming they find that particular pocket of the village or the town has a problem, you mean DECT wouldn't require an admission program?
Like,
when the borough doesn't have the power to begin with?
Madam Chair, Lynn Varelli from the Department of Environmental Conservation.
This is your fault.
No, we can blame it on EPA. the inspection and maintenance program is just one of many kind of programs that could be instituted to solve a particular pollution problem. In the case of Anchorage or Fairbanks, it's motor vehicles. In the case of a village of 1,000, it may be a turbine put in by some oil company. It's flexible, and you really don't know until the problem does arise and what the solution to that problem would be. So it's not that the vehicle inspection program would be brought in. That's not the case. And it's an option if there's a lot of vehicles causing the problem. But you have to attack the problem, not just the general. Just not general.
Then why do we need anything at all? That's the Senate person 2012 taking. Just because we have the way it is, why even pull villages 1,000
feet? That's fine.
It sounds to me that the section is drafted incorrectly. And we send it back to legislative legal. We tell them what we want. We don't involve towns or villages above or beyond 1,000. We only are dealing with Anchorage and Fairbanks here. Is that right? Is that what I'm hearing from the committee?
That's all we want.
Thank you all. We will send this back to the drawing board, and we'll bring it up again later.
Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Soldat.
Okay. Next before us, we have Senate Bill 21. But Lisa, thank you for bringing that to our attention. That was good anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
Senate Bill 21.
Stumbling into something here.
Yes. Gosh. How awful.
What happens in the last days, I can tell you.
Okay. Senate Bill 21
we aren't moving very
is relating to, it's a part of the child abuse package. What I'd like to do is pass out Senator Sackett's staff and my staff both did an analysis of all the fiscal notes, and all we did is his staff really did an analysis. All we did was put them all down on one sheet of paper for everybody so that you can see them. The most confusing part about the child abuse legislation is the fiscal notes. Senate Bill 21 has two fiscal notes, one from the Department of Health and Social Services, one from Public Safety. They total $209,000. Let's talk about the bill first, and then I guess we'll get into the fiscal notes, maybe. This bill, let's see. Who is here to testify on Senate Bill 21? Please come forward.
Madam Chairman, committee members, I'm Jim Vaden from Public Safety.
Jim, does the department support the bill?
Yes, we do.
You want to tell us a little bit about the bill?
Well, the bill is designed to allow a background check to be done on individuals that are supervising minors. Specifically, it requires that individuals that are hired in a specific job classification to oversee minors, that those individuals specifically are subjected to a background check by the Department of Public Safety. And then there's certain exclusionary sections for certain types of classifications of offenses which would preclude them from that type of employment.
Questions for Mr. Baden? Senator Fisher?
Just to make sure we're talking the same thing, this does include the public and private school teachers. Uh-huh.
It's not required for school teachers. There's presently a existing law that says that the school districts can request background checks, and in fact they are complying with that for a great part. So there's many other sections covered by the original law that was a voluntary act, which would in fact possibly protect some of those individuals from some civil liability, and I'm not certain of that because I'm not an attorney, but for child daycare centers, foster homes, and so forth, this law requires that those individuals receive a background check.
So then the only exclusion would be the public school, private school systems in the event is voluntary for them if they so choose.
It's voluntary for them. It's voluntary for the people at Burger King who may hire a lot of young people during the summertime to go ahead and have a background check done on their supervisors. But foster homes, daycare centers, and those type of institutions is what this bill specifically addresses. It expands what's already in existence, which is the voluntary compliance in the background.
The last question is, we had talked about the cost. Is the cost of this picked up by the firm doing the hiring or the employee? Why shouldn't you have teachers?
I don't believe that's specifically addressed here. There are charges from the federal side for a background check, and we have to submit a $12 check with the fingerprint cards in order to have the feds check that. I encouraged at several committee meetings that they attach a cost to this, which would in fact cover probably the physical notes involved, and that could be a $20 or $25 charge, which could possibly include the taking of the fingerprints, which aren't included here, and I've suggested that those fingerprints could be taken at a private process server and a private investigative agency, but those services are available in Anchorage and Juneau, but there's a fee to the public of $5 to $7.50, depending on where it gets done. Neither Health or Social Services or Public Safety particularly wants to get involved in rolling out the prints of 20,000 people, because then the physical notes are going to bloom. But at the present time, it would be a $12 check, and it really wouldn't make any difference to us where it came from. That would go to the FBI.
I have a question.
Senator Petula. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Fisher.
I guess my concern was, I support the bill, but my concern is the fee. No. Is it a legitimate fee for the employer to say to the employee, it will come out of your pay, or can the employee come back and force the employer to pay for it? Do you expect any kind of a labor relations type of issue over this?
Well, I don't. We require our employees to go down and have a medical examination done, and you know, pre-employment, they pay for that.
Okay.
We don't.
Okay.
Further questions for Mr. Baden? Senator Petula.
What are you doing in this legislation that duplicates, say, Health and Social Services or some other agency, where is the duplications of services in Senate Bill 21? So we're not paying, we don't wish to pay for the same services to be partially duplicated or to be duplicated. What are you doing that's the same as the other agencies?
I don't think that we're doing anything in a duplicate.
The other agency is doing something that you're doing. Or the other agency doing something you're doing.
Well, not to my knowledge. And I, you know, since I'm not with Health and Social Services, I don't really have much knowledge regarding their physical note. It's my understanding that those individuals who are going to be employed will have to have a background check done, and that would be by us. We will provide Health and Social Services with a temporary clearance while we're waiting for the clearance from the FBI. But we're going to be doing the majority of the correspondence now. Someone will have to interface to make sure that the foster home that's going to be licensed has the proper background checks, and I would imagine that that's what Health and Social Services will do prior to licensing that home.
Chairperson?
Yes, sir.
As important as this package is, you have to watch out for what I like to call the Xerox syndrome. And that is where more than one agency starts to use the services or duplicate services that only one agency needs, and everybody needs it. And we're getting a situation where it looks like everybody needs it in here, and that's the reason I think we ought to be careful to ask those questions. Where are duplications? Where can it be tightened up so that there's more money to serve on the service, not more money to waste while pretending to be doing something?
Well, I can certainly appreciate your concern, and you know, I think that the tasks that we have to provide are fairly well outlined. You know, we're going to get a request to do a background investigation. With that request will be fingerprint cards. We'll do an inquiry through our computer system. We'll also do an inquiry through our automated fingerprint identification system to ensure whether or not we have that individual in our system and whether or not there's a criminal record. We're then going to have to produce some type of correspondence back to the requesting firm, such as a daycare center, advising them that we have nothing on file and that they have permission to temporarily hire this individual. Otherwise, it would be 3 months before a person could get a job, so that has to be done fairly rapidly. Then we're going to transmit this document to the FBI with the remittance of the proper sum of money. We're going to get a response back from the FBI. We're then going to have to pull that file. We're going to have to update the record back to the foster home or daycare center, telling them that this person has cleared the background investigation, or they have not cleared for the following reasons. So that's what our role is in this process.
Thank you.
Senator Eliason.
Madam Chair, as an example, the information you receive will not only contain convictions, but also contain charges and those types of things that are on the record. Is that right? And then what you're going to, if there are in fact no convictions, even though there's been a number of incidents that did not result in a conviction, that information will not be passed on.
That's correct. We're limited by what we can pass on by statute right now, and it's very, very explicit. And the only thing I can tell you is that, you know, particularly with the national checks, because of the sloppy handling of some of the dispositions over the past many years, if we got back a check that indicated that this individual had been arrested 12 times for some type of sexual abuse, we'd probably be on the phone checking with the jurisdiction that made the arrest to determine whether, you know, why is there no dispo on this? Because oftentimes an individual could have been convicted and there would be no dispo because it just wasn't sent into the FBI.
But you could see a pattern develop in charges or arrests made for specific sexual crimes. However, through lack of any convictions,
it would not be released.
Would not be released, so the clever people are going to slip through this net. I can understand the problems you have in just addressing those who've been charged with it. However, if there's a certain pattern that has developed over the years, it seems to me that that's really pertinent to what we're looking for. I don't know how you'd handle that because you have some real, you know, balances there to make. But those are the ones that really bother me. You read numerous cases where people have been charged with those types of crimes and maybe they negotiated their way out. Just leave town and we'll forget it. Well, these people might be ending up here in Alaska.
That's correct.
And we could have a list, you know, a mile long, providing there's no convictions. They could go to work the next day. I don't know how he plugged that loophole. That bothers me.
Further discussion, Senator Fisher?
No, one of the problems I have with the bill is, and I think Senator Eliason brought it out, although I'm still going to support the bill, we're only talking about convictions, and we're talking about promoting prostitution, for example.
if a person is engaged in promoting prostitution in a state where it's legal, such as Las Vegas, then it's okay. If the person does it somewhere, and it will never show anywhere that they were promoting prostitution because it's legal in that state. And I don't know how you get around that either.
It's not legal in the state.
It isn't in Las Vegas. Oh, then if it's not legal, you might stand corrected.
Can you tell us about it, Senator?
I've never been in the state of Nevada except Carson City. I've been in Carson City at the Capitol. So.
Further questions for Mr. Vaden?
That is not legal.
Okay, Senator Sackett, can you?
It's not bad.
Okay, gentlemen, we've got so much to do today. Senator Sackett, can you give the committee your idea about how to handle all these fiscal notes, or what do
you think?
Don't
you remember where I last saw you?
Okay. Senator Petula.
What I'd recommend is we've got, six bills, is to take the original agency request, then another line that shows what the House sent over in terms of their recommendations, and then another line that we have a nice breakout here, too, and then another line that shows it by department, how much the troopers are asking throughout the whole thing.
Yes.
Then take that against the existing bodies that we have. There's a passout there. Lost it. There's a passout we have in here that shows what exists in the present budget. The present budget we have existing today for child abuse in all the different areas. Just analyze it against that and see how much they think they do.
That is excellent.
Right.
We'll get a handle on it.
Okay. Now, are there any more questions about the substance of Senate Bill 21? Okay. Thank you, sir, very much. What I'd like to do then is it the committee's intention to move out Senate Bill 21 as soon as we get a handle on the fiscal notes?
I would think so.
Objections to moving out 21?
No.
Okay. So why don't we hold 21 right now, then we will, there's a plan to move it out as soon as we get a handle on the fiscal notes. Would that be a good way of handling it?
Yes. Okay. Question of Hess, perhaps.
Great. Okay. So 21 is on its way. Senate Bill 232 is not a child abuse bill. It's a request by Senator Fahrenkamp for a problem that she's got. Is Senator Fahrenkamp still here?
Yes.
Great. Yeah. She's concerned about moving this out today. Yes. Oh, yes, please. Senator Fahrenkamp, would you tell us about Senate Bill 232 and the CS that's proposed by the senators being passed up? She's doing a dastardly thing here.
Well, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I think all of you know of my long-standing desire to try to help the independents get moving on the slope. And what this is allowing the commissioner the discretion to waive work commitments for a period of 2 years when there are extinguishing circumstances. Now, they can do that now if a unit has been declared in any of the sites. But before a unit is declared, it's not possible to do. And I think the amendment's pretty self-explanatory, except that it just provides some flexibility in dealing with independent operators on their lands. Happy to answer any questions, or the department is here.
Senator Fahrenkamp is taking one of her bills that's in the committee on GVEA. We have the House bill before us, so it's not like the House vehicle is the vehicle of motion. She's taking an existing Senate bill that she had under her name. She asked if it was possible to put this new language there, in other words, use the number, and go for an extension for these independents on the slope. Is that correctly stated?
Yes, that's true. One of the problems, Madam Chairman, is that the funding you have certain times that you can drill. And out of a 5-year work plan, for instance, you have about 28 months for work. Unless you can afford to do a lot of transporting by helicopter and these kinds of things, you cannot work when there's no ice roads available or during those sessions. And it makes it very hard for those who do not have millions to invest to stay involved. And that's what we're trying to do is protect those independent unions. Only at the discretion of the commissioner and when there are extenuating circumstances, like availability to get gravel in time, these kinds of things.
Senator, what are the negatives here? What are we going to allow happen that we're not foreseeing right now?
The only negative is that, and the reason for the work plans is to make sure that somebody doesn't get a lease and just hold on to it and not develop it.
Right.
And this would only affect those who are truly blind, who have spent funds in drilling and networking, and still are not able to meet that five-year timetable. It would extend it only for 2 years, which is about approximately 9 months more of work that they could accomplish.
Is this going to benefit speculators?
No, it isn't.
Senator Curtula?
Has this bill been heard in a different number in another committee?
No, it hasn't. It's been discussed, but not heard as a bill. We just put the bill in shape here. We've been trying to solve this problem for about a month and a half now. And rather than doing it through the whole system as we finally worked out how to manage it, we tried this approach.
We are not pulling a bill from another committee.
No, we are not. I don't do that.
Senator Fisher.
In the backup, I think I understand the drilling and producing, but under what circumstance would the commissioner, for example, change a royalty requirement?
Well, the royalty requirement is the work plan that's issued. And they have to have, for instance, if you have a lease and your drilling has not gotten to the point that you have proved the pool to get a unit, then as it stands right now, you could lose that lease, no matter if you've invested $9 million or some have. You could lose that lease until you can prove that there's enough oil there to form a unit. This is giving a two-year-only extension in cases where the commissioner deems it's advisable.
Okay, so it doesn't have anything to do with changing any kind of royalty that the state would be getting, lessening or increasing it?
Not at all. And one of the reasons I think this is important is that we're looking at reduction in drilling and exploration. And we certainly need to be encouraging, not discouraging, those who are truly trying.
Senator Fisher? Ferguson?
Yes. Madam Chair, could we hear from the department?
I have one question before the department.
Senator Curtula, then Senator Lyson has a question.
Just one question. I certainly do support the committee substitute. However, I'm curious what happened to the original bill. Is that coming through the process, or is that?
Yes, it is. It's here from the House.
Okay.
And the House version got here before our version got there.
Senator Curtula?
Yes. The words apparently are artful, and if a minimum work commitment is not fulfilled, what is the definition of minimum work commitment?
Those are laid out within the contracts under which the bid's made, and it's done by regulation from the department.
So there is a definition of minimum work commitment. It's not necessarily, there is one that this pertains to. It's not like, say, prudent rule, which means many different things sometimes, a prudent man.
No, they have that set out by regulation and is put into the bid contract itself.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Fahrenkamp.
Thank you.
Do we have someone from the department here? Kay, are you here to speak on this committee substitute for 232?
Yes, ma'am. For the record, I'm Kay Brown with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. We have been working to try to address the problem. I guess viewed one way, the problem is people's leases are expiring and they would like to have more time. There right now is a provision where upon a certain showing you can get a unit. And I think that this approach is preferable to having units where the information, the showing has not been made and we would be addressing a large block of acreage. I think this is a more responsible approach and we do support this. And that's basically all I have to say, Madam Chairman.
Questions for the department? Senator Curtula.
Did you come up with this idea as a solution to some problem or other you're now having? Does it come out of your department this way?
Well, we've been asked to try to address this problem. There are these people who would like to have units, and they're pending in our division, and we have taken the position that they have not made the minimum showing that the regulations require to get an exploratory unit. Now, once you get into a unit, the acreage is held for a longer time, or it can be held for 5 years, and then upon, you know, there is discretion to modify the work commitments once you get into a unit. The concept was that people would go out and get geophysical information and define a prospect, and upon the definition of a prospect, they could form a unit. And in the opinion of our professional staff, that has not occurred, but what we'd be addressing here would be, you know, a single lease and looking at the circumstances regarding whether the lessee has been able to get the permits, get the gravel, did the weather delay, and whatever extenuating circumstances they might put forward. So having a single opportunity for 1 2-year extension, I think, is a reasonable way to go at it, and we do not have that authority now. The only way now to save those leases is put them in a unit, and I think giving this escape valve, you know, one more chance, which often we get those kinds of requests, you know, for units, is a reasonable approach.
I'll ask you the same question I asked Senator Fearnkamp. Is this a speculator bill?
No, I'm sure there are a lot of the large oil companies that also be interested in pursuing that extension should they have a situation.
Are we opening up the window of a terrific change in policy?
Well, you have leases, and we have, as a matter of policy, stopped using work commitments per se. The statute authorizes them. They're discretionary. We had them in the 79 sale. We had them in the 80 sale. We've not been using them lately. The effect of those particular ones as they were used in that sale was to make it be a 5-year lease instead of a 10-year lease, because it said within 5 years or 7 years, you must drill or commit to a unit. That's what that commitment said for those particular leases. So it's not a major change in policy as I see it.
Senator Curtula.
And I could speculate out here, and I don't mean it's a term that we just use, but I could speculate personally that I would have one lease for problems that were not foreseen. I had a good plan, I had a lease, I did a lot of work out there. Mm-hmm. But for problems I could not foresee, all of a sudden I've had to delay, and hence, in order to maintain even getting my money back, I would probably just have to put it into a unit and let some major grab me up and do back to them.
If you even had the information necessary to establish the unit. Say, for example, you had someone who had been making a good faith effort to drill, and this situation did occur, and they had put in for their permit and got a request or got an opinion from Environmental Conservation exactly what they had to do, and then Environmental Conservation changed their policy and added a lot of new requirements that they were not aware of. And then when they came back in with their information, they said, well, we've changed our policy. Now here are 72 more things you have to do to qualify. And, you know, that situation...
Those are the things you'd be looking at.
That type of situation, I would view this, that they would have had to do something. They would have had to make a good faith effort to be on their way to drilling their well or getting their seismic or whatever exploration they were doing and be able to demonstrate that there was something beyond their control that prevented them from making it by the deadline, in which case there would be one opportunity for extension. And then if they don't make it, it's all over. And that's the way it is now. We have no authority to extend either make... They either